To order, we have one item on our council work session agenda. And we're also doing a kind of a virtual hybrid with a few of our members who were unable to be in person today. And this is not a see and be seen. So this is just basically virtual participation for our council members. Okay, thank you. All right, so up on our agenda today, we have discussions around the water treatment plant upgrade. So I'll kick it over to you, Carlin, or Dave.
I'll turn it over to Director of Utilities, Dave Sorrell, and he'll present the Big Bang water treatment plant.
Thank you for being here this evening and let us give some updates on the project at the water treatment plant. So what we're going to do this evening is kind of give you a brief history and show you where we're at with a proposed base bid and alternates, and then also have a discussion about advanced treatment, which is not part of this project currently, but it's something we may want to consider in the future. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Sean Carrico. He's the engineering supervisor for the water division, and he'll begin the presentation.
Thank you, Director Sorrell. Madam Mayor, Council, pleasure to be here tonight. There's two bullet points on your agenda tonight. The first is an update on our current phase one improvement project for the water treatment plant. And then towards the end of the presentation, we're going to go into what was part of the scope of the design of this project and the alternative analysis. My clicker's working. Can you go to the next slide? So a quick summary of our agenda tonight. As I said, the first item is an update on where we're at on the current project. We're going to go over the project purpose, how we intend to modernize our water treatment plant. At that point, then I'll call on members of HDR staff, our consultant for the project, and they're going to go through some detail on the project scope, where we're at with current market conditions and opinions of cost on the project. And additionally, the second item on your agenda is the alternative analysis and pilot study summary. We set out with this project, we had four main goals for the project purpose. The first is to replace aging infrastructure to enhance the reliability of our plant. The second is to restore the treatment capacity of the plant. And the third goal for the current project is to improve the current treatment performance. The fourth goal up there, as we'll dive into as the second part of our presentation tonight, is the alternative analysis and what the future of our water plant may look like, as well as advanced treatment alternatives. And you'll be seeing these pictures as we go throughout the presentation, so you can relate them back to the four main goals. A little bit of history and the reason why we need to modernize our plant. Our plant was originally constructed in 1970, had original capacity of 16 million gallons a day. There's been two subsequent expansions of 8 million gallons each to bring the plant to 32 million gallons. In recent studies over the past few years, we've reduced that reliable capacity, as we like to refer to it, and that's due to age of the plant and condition of the equipment and stuff. So we tend to say that our plant only has a reliable capacity of 24 million gallons a day, even though it was originally designed for 32. So that's where we need to restore some of that capacity comes into play with this project. And you know, many of the components are at the end of their expected life. Many of them are, particularly the original components, are more than 50 years old, and that's well beyond how long we would expect them to last. Next slide. We approached this project. We had an original budget of $24.5 million. There was $23 million that was included in the 2018 water bond issue. And then we also had another concurrent project on the books to do some work with our aerators. Those were combined to give us an approximate budget of $24.5 million for the entire project. The other bullet points are the major goals that we set out to replace the aerators, a portion of the basin equipment, the majority of the 2400 volt electrical gear, and replace and improve our chemical feed systems, as well as doing some improvements to our filter building. Those were kind of the main goals of the project. With that, I'm going to turn things over to Ryan Saffels from HDR. He's going to walk you through HDR's scope of services and give you current updates on the current project.
Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. So again, I'm Ryan Saffels with HDR. Just to kind of give a quick overview of our contract scope, the eight tasks on the screen kind of delineate that. Task one was project management. Task two, field surveys and investigation included topographic surveys, boundary surveys of the site, and then also a field investigation, geotechnical work, and things of that nature. Task three is pilot testing and alternative treatment analysis. That's the second bullet that Sean mentioned on tonight's agenda that Trent Stover is going to talk about here after me. Task four was easement drawings and assistance ultimately not needed for the project. Task five was design document preparation. That's largely construction documents, plans and specs. Yes. Task six is permitting, so MDNR and city permitting. And then task seven, bid phase services are pending and stakeholder involvement was task eight. So the first goal that Sean mentioned of the project was replacing aging infrastructure for enhanced reliability. As part of the contract scope and as identified during our field investigation, we evaluated each piece of major equipment throughout the treatment process to determine its age, its condition, its life expectancy, performance impacts or issues, and then identify what solidify the contract scope in terms of what actually was going to be included in the contract documents for replacement. And that included ultimately all major process equipment, from aerators to softening basin equipment, filtration components, chem feed systems, and instrumentation. And with those replacements, then reliability of new equipment is obviously going to be significantly improved from what's there. The second primary goal was restoring treatment capacity. So we identified and evaluated various hydraulic constraints in the system and performance constraints. And with the correction of those hydraulic constraints and the process improvements, that reliable capacity is restored to 32 MGD with much reduced downtime of equipment. The third goal was improving treatment performance. So with those process equipment improvements from the aerators, replacing the aerators improves iron and manganese removal efficiency. Replacing the clarifier mechanisms and improving the lime feed equipment improves the lime softening process, which reduces pass-through of solids to the filters, which can overload filters. Improving chem feed systems improves not only reliability but redundancy of those systems as well as dosing optimization. The filters are being completely rehabilitated, and that improves filter performance for solids removal or turbidity removal out of the finished water. And then monitoring and controls throughout the plant gives the city the ability to monitor trends in more real time and react to impacts in either varying raw water quality as new wells are brought on or just optimizing chem feed and making sure there's no issues with performance. This slide illustrates, kind of summarizes from an excerpt from Bureau of Labor Statistics from 2020 to 2022, outlining for major construction materials some cost increases that we've experienced. And water and wastewater treatment plant projects are heavy infrastructure involved, and most all of these components are pretty heavy in the McBain improvements, from ready-mix concrete, miscellaneous steel products, piping, conduit, wiring, mill-shaped steel and metals, rebar, stainless steel pipe, diesel fuel, and transportation costs. So these increases, just in this excerpt alone, range from 17 to 212% increase from 2020 numbers and have a significant impact on the McBain plant's cost estimate. This is from ENR, and this kind of illustrates regional construction cost index for average market conditions, average materials over the same period in this region. So from January of 2020 to about October of 22, this illustrates an average cumulative construction cost index increase of about 14%. And that, those are average conditions. So McBain deals a lot with the heavy industry stuff that we saw on the last graph. So the cost impacts to the McBain project have been significantly greater than the 14% average. You can also see, if you look at the trending on this, that it appears that maybe through the latter part of 2022, the cost index is leveling out or hopefully coming back down. We're hoping that that trend continues into next year. And based on those findings, the scope, the field investigation, the design analysis, and the cost impacts, HDR met with city staff and developed staff's recommended phased approach to construction in order to address market conditions and stage the project so that it is executable. This diagram kind of illustrates the model that we generated for the plant in order to capture all of the improvements plant-wide and put them succinctly in a set of bid documents. And so it kind of models the whole plant, both existing and new components that have been designed. The blue box illustrates current improvements, so that's what's currently in the base bid. Largely captures all of the major process improvements through the plant, from raw water supply on the north into the aerators, through clarifiers and secondary basins and filter building, and then ultimately includes a new chemical feed building on the southeast or the bottom right of the page as well. The deferred improvements shown in purple are basically the electrical backbone replacement, which is reducing the existing 2400 volt system down to a 480 volt distribution system, and installation of a new high service pump station, which I'll talk a little bit more about here shortly. This slide kind of gives a breakdown of what's in the base bid improvements outlined in blue on the prior slide. The current estimate for this work is $25 million. It is a little bit above the city's budget. In order to be conservative, we've included a market volatility factor in our latest cost estimates, which prior to 2020, we didn't typically or really rarely ever did include. So that's new. And then we also included a relatively conservative escalation to the midpoint of construction. Those two things have added to the construction costs. We're hoping that they're over conservative, and we're hoping that the trends we saw on one of the last graphs is actually showing a decline and continues to decline into next year. But the base bid improvements again include all the major improvements necessary to hit the three primary goals, which are illustrated on the right there: replacing aging infrastructure, restoring treatment capacity, and improving treatment performance. This slide outlines add alternate improvements. So these improvements were determined by city staff to be less critical than the base bid improvements. They include maintenance building, electrical improvements, filter building architectural improvements, and the addition of a new recarbonation or carbon dioxide chemical feed system. They're currently in the $4 million range for those add alternates. The design has been done on those improvements, and they are included in the bid documents and outlined for individual itemized pricing. So at bid time, the city will open the bids, see where all the bids come in, base bid, and add alternates, and decide what moves forward as part of the actual construction project. And then this slide outlines the deferred improvements I talked about, largely the electrical backbone and the new high service pump station. And they're still necessary improvements. They're not deemed by city staff to be as critical as the others, given the budget constraints on the project. But basically, the existing high service pumps are direct coupled to filters, which does or can have a tendency to draw a vacuum on filters closest to the pumps in operation and result in turbidity breakthrough. This new high service pump station would add a new gravity flow filter effluent header, allowing the filters to free flow to a wet well and reduce negative impacts on treatment performance. That kind of summarizes my piece this evening, and I'll let Trent or Sean turn it over to Trent.
Yep.
And just so you all know, I'll probably bring y'all back up when we have questions, but we figured you can kind of go through, just in case you're wanting, Trent, while we're so quiet.
Well, sure. Well, however you all want to handle this,
that's great.
We can
pop
through this. Again, Trent Stober with
HD. Also, page numbers in the future, Trent, in case you haven't been to the first council meeting. They really like page numbers on slides. So Okay.
Got me there. We actually got Ryan. So, Ryan. But this portion of the presentation is focused on the studies that were done to inform future potential advanced treatment alternatives. So as Ryan mentioned, the three primary objectives that we went through with the design and so forth, really at the project at hand, this is to evaluate the economic, non-economic type factors associated with different levels of advanced treatment. This was a handout. Hopefully, this might have been actually from previous council. Actually, it was provided, but I'm sure there's access available to all the newer council members as well. But this kind of walks through at a high level the studies that were at hand. And the primary focus of these studies below that title block was really focused around disinfection byproducts. So when we disinfect our water, the disinfectants can react with compounds in the water to form byproducts that have potential human health considerations. The EPA regulates several of those. There's a number of other non-regulated disinfection byproducts that are important as well, but we just have less understanding about. And I'll walk through some more details of that in just a moment. But when we conducted the study, we started at a small scale, at a bench scale, to more cost-effectively move towards a pilot scale, what we term as a pilot scale. So at the bench scale, we did various studies to really inform this pilot scale study, which is essentially like a mini treatment plant that we put out at the McBain Water Treatment Plant that simulated a number of processes that the city could deploy into the future. So we ran this study for about 6 months. There's three different processes that we evaluated on that on the skid or on that pilot study. There's videos of some of those processes on the public-facing website if you're interested in it. Essentially, the focus is around different processes to use activated carbon, which is similar to is the same type of substrate that you use in a Brita filter or maybe the cartridges you might have in your refrigerator to remove taste and odors in your drinking water. We evaluated first a way to integrate that into the existing filter system, so there would be virtually no capital cost associated with it. We also evaluated what would simulate a separate treatment process, a separate set of chambers to put activated carbon at the back end of the water treatment plant. And then another process was to use ozone, which is an oxidant, breaks up some of the organic compounds into readily consumable carbon that biology can actually remove naturally and more sustainably. So there you don't have to replace the organic or the activated carbon. You just have organisms working for you to remove some of the compounds that would end up becoming disinfection byproducts. So we evaluated all those types of systems. We landed with the current water quality that we had to evaluate. We landed on this separate process, a granular activated carbon contactor that would be supplemental or in addition to the current treatment process, separate system, which is denoted in the bottom. Going back to the formation of disinfection byproducts, and I hope you can take the time. I think this is an important concept to think through when we make a decision ultimately about our choice of disinfectants. So essentially we have raw water that has various characteristics that reacts with a chemical disinfectant. And in this case, we could have free chlorine. We studied ozone. And then also chloramines that end up over time to form these disinfection byproducts. Again, the three shown here on this slide are the primary ones regulated by the EPA. Now, when we disinfect water for control of potential pathogens and protect public health, we start with a primary disinfectant. So this is the disinfectant we're relying on to kill pathogens that might be in the source water. And then we add a secondary disinfectant to control any biological growth outside of the water treatment plant. So as the water goes through our distribution systems to our homes, businesses, and so forth, we have to have something in place to avoid microorganisms to grow in the system. So that's a secondary disinfectant. The city right now uses free chlorine as a primary disinfectant, so to get a kill at the water treatment plant. It's only exposed for a short amount of time, so it doesn't form excessive levels of disinfection byproducts. And then we add chloramines to the system to control that growth in the system. So you essentially stop the reaction to form these disinfection byproducts that are regulated by EPA. Now, there are considerations about some of the non-regulated disinfection byproducts. In particular, the one that has been brought up mostly is NDMA, which is associated with chloramines. For the evaluation of how we might be able to go to free chlorine as that secondary disinfectant, this trihalomethanes was the most important disinfection byproduct to focus in on. Now, there are only a few things that we can do to affect the formation of trihalomethanes, and as I mentioned, the chemical disinfectant is very important. So again, to control that right now in the system, we use free chlorine as the primary disinfectant. Secondary disinfectant is chloramines to meet our regulatory requirements. Time in the distribution system is not something that's very easily controlled. So that is a variable that we can drop out of the equation, essentially. We did make recommendations on how to reduce the time the water spends in the distribution system that the city could carry forward, but it's not a significant portion of this disinfection byproduct discussion. Either is temperature, because we can't really control temperature very well in the system as well. And then pH is another one that really is not an issue when it comes to trihalomethanes in particular. TOC, the total organic carbon, the carbon that ends up forming with a chlorine to make these trihalomethanes is the most important one that we focused in on. And we evaluated, we ran the studies for quite some time to evaluate what levels of organic carbon we can have in the water to safely meet different water quality goals. And that's a primary important point to all of this. So when we think about what the long-term costs of this, these sets of improvements would be to go to free chlorine as that secondary disinfectant, we have to think about what's our goal with respect to these regulated compounds, particularly trihalomethanes. So the maximum contaminant level is 80 micrograms per liter. So think of that as that's the floor that you would want as a water quality goal, the absolute minimum, just to pass regulatory compliance. Most utilities don't pick that as the goal to just get by, basically. We want some safety factor built into that and do a little bit better than a regulatory requirement. A common goal is 80% of that maximum contaminant level, which is 64 micrograms per liter. The current level in the Columbia system is around 40 micrograms per liter, so about half of the maximum contaminant level, which is great. But if we go to the free chlorine, we need to think about what level of organic carbon do we need to maintain to hit those different targets. So in this case, you can see the levels of organic carbon to meet the current level of disinfection byproducts. We would need to strive for a 0.6 milligram per liter carbon goal. What that means is that we have to replace that activated carbon more frequently to get to these lower levels of organic carbon, because that carbon kind of breaks through the system. So think of it in terms of how frequently you would need to change your filter in your refrigerator or your Brita filter. Hopefully you change yours more frequently than mine.
That's
so anyway, but and so what we've gone through in the evaluation is to evaluate, okay, how frequently would we need to replace all the activated carbon in the system to meet these different goals? And it ranges anywhere from twice a year to a little bit over once a year, or a little bit beyond once a year, depending on those goals. That is completely translatable to cost, since each pound of carbon costs a certain amount to replace. So this is taking that replacement interval and translating it into dollars. So to meet that minimum level of regulatory compliance, it's about $3 million, about $7 million to a year to attain the current level if we went back to free chlorine. So to put that into perspective on bills, back of the envelope would be essentially every $1 million you spent in annual operating costs would translate to about $1.67 per month per household. Okay. So there's a number of things. That's just the annual costs. So again, we're looking at, you know, $3 to $7 million. I wouldn't really consider striving for that lowest level. That's just the minimum level. I would tend towards this 80% to the current levels. So that we also have a capital cost requirement. Now, fortunately, Ryan and the design team figured out a way to allow us to implement this without stranding any of the existing assets that we're recommending the investments into. No major assets that are left behind. The capital cost in 2020 dollars without all the escalation that we've seen is about $50 million. That's beyond the current recommended set of bids, the alternate bids, and the deferred costs or the deferred improvements. So about $50 million on top of what we're considering right now, and then also the for this case, $4 million a year in operational costs, and then another $7 million if we hit today's level. One thing to think about is some of the non-cost factors with the decision. And we're not making a recommendation one way or the other. I think this is something the council needs to take forward and the customers need to consider in terms of what the long-range recommendations are. But when we think about these two secondary disinfectants, again, what we're trying to control, microbial growth in the distribution system, we've got this chloramines and free chlorine, and this is the trade-off that we have. The reason we use free chlorine as that primary disinfectant is that it's very strong oxidizer. It kills stuff really quickly. So that's a positive when we're looking at killing these potential harmful organisms in the source water. In the distribution system where we have long residence time, it becomes more of a detriment. So it's more aggressive, it means it is less stable, and it gets consumed in the system versus chloramine, which is pretty stable within the system. So you have the potential for microbial growth in the system. We mitigate that with potential adding chlorine in the system, so you'd actually add chlorine at different spots potentially to overcome that. Now, it is, when we look at the regulated compounds on the books right now, chloramines weighs in over that, but that's why the activated carbon, you know, this cost of the activated carbon is trying to mitigate that red X. Both of the issues, you know, have some regular or unregulated disinfection byproducts. So with chloramines, with the way that the system's set up right now, we actually monitored at some places within the distribution system where the water age was kind of highest. It had the longest time to react with chloramines, and we found very little. If you know, some samples were non-detect, others were less than 10 nanograms per liter, so a pretty low level of NDMA. Free chlorine, we didn't assess any of those unregulated disinfection byproducts. One thing to keep in mind too is the sustainability of the system, and particularly around greenhouse gas emissions, which I know the city has been focused on for quite some time. And so when we look at that, you know, we can mitigate a lot of the red X's on that matrix. One thing that we can't really mitigate is the sustainability discussion. So to create activated carbon, you actually take an organic or anthracite, a coal or something, and create activated carbon, which is a pretty energy-intensive process. So we evaluated the amount of carbon associated with generating that activated carbon in terms of CO2 emissions and came to a pretty high level of 232,000 tons that would be an indirect impact from the use of activated carbon in this situation. We've made a comparison to the 2020 Climate Action Report, which I assume you're probably familiar with, and the amount of CO2 production estimated from current water and wastewater treatment plant operations, which is about 10 times less. Now, to be fair, we did not evaluate the indirect impacts of all the chemicals that we use in the water treatment plant or in the wastewater treatment plant and so forth. So it's not quite an apples to apples comparison, but it's something that I think that we need to consider moving forward. So here's our recommended next steps to wrap it up and then pull up Ryan for all the hard questions. You know, to move forward with bidding the project, as Ryan mentioned, you know, to make sure that we've got the contracting authority to do that, the project funding and so forth. The deferred improvements are important. So there's enhanced filtration controls that we'll have that that would further aid our finished water quality. Now, one thing Ryan didn't mention, in that base bid, there are some control valves on the filters to try to mitigate some of the impacts that he talked about with the high service pumps. So the with that, we're striving to meet groundwater under the influence turbidity requirements with the base package. This deferred set of improvements, if that's not successful, would be your next step to make sure we meet that goal. There's also obsolescent equipment, particularly in the electrical equipment that needs to be replaced. There's some things we can do in the meantime, and particularly when after we've made these improvements. So like I mentioned, the water quality that we studied was the current water quality in the water treatment plant. We're making significant improvements in the aerators, the softening basins that will reduce that organic carbon, the amount of that, we're not sure about, but there'll be an improvement in water quality, and it could change some of the economics of the processes that I just walked through. So I think once this is installed, I would recommend that we evaluate the improvements of that and whether that would shift any of the information to make a better informed decision. The other thing that I think would be important, we just took snapshots of this unregulated disinfection byproduct, NDMA, during our studies. I think it would make sense to do some more routine monitoring to really assess the levels that we have in the system so that, again, once we get to the stage of identifying whether or not enhanced treatment is something the city wants to go forward, we know the risks associated with that or an estimate of the risks, and then also to weigh that with the cost and the non-economic factors that I mentioned. So that's all of the prepared presentation. Appreciate your patience with all that.
Thank you, Trent. So I'm going to start just a few questions. And also, I think one thing I wanted to note is I know you all have been with us for a while on making this project for the water treatment plant, and I don't think anybody in Columbia would agree that it has not happened fast enough. So I'm just putting that out there that we all wish this happened 2 years ago. We know that, and we know that there's been leadership changes and things happening, so we know the frustration, but I'm happy to see that we've had so many presentations in the last 6 months on the water treatment plant. One question I had was that I think you all made a presentation to the Water and Light Advisory Board, and Sean, this might be for you or for Dave, and I was wondering if they had a response or recommendations to us.
Yes, we made a very similar presentation this month's Water and Light Advisory Board meeting, so the November meeting. In general, they're supportive of, you know, the project going forward. There's understanding of the market conditions that we're currently in and how that's evolved since the project was originally conceived to date. So strongly in support of the current project getting done as soon as possible, as you referenced.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is not, we don't have the option of demolition by neglect, so I like those. The other questions that I know we've been asked before, this might be for Trent, your reference to a Brita filter, while candid, it alarms me because I don't know where mine is either on my refrigerator. When we talk about that, that is usually a small system. If I remember when I was looking into this. So the activated carbon are usually small water treatment distribution systems. Am I right? Or,
well, there's different scales. So
okay.
The Brita filter or your refrigerator cartridge is an example. Or there's even systems that you could get from a private water supplier, you know, along with softening system and so forth, is a point of use treatment device. So the benefit of that is you're only treating the water that you consume. So if you, the standard rule is, or estimate is 2 liters per day per person. So that's about 2/3 of a gallon. So let's say you have a household of three, you drink 2 gallons of water. Now that it excludes what you take a shower in, you know, what you use for food and so forth, but the vast majority is for non-consumptive uses. So that's where the point of use filter becomes attractive. Now, granular activated carbon at a water treatment plant has been used quite a bit in, I'd have to go back and try to track down how many systems are in place, but they're significant and for different purposes. You know, one would be this disinfection byproduct issue. Others would be other contaminants that are kind of on the scene right now, like per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, which is kind of like Teflon and so forth. So actually, one of the largest systems out there is directed towards removing something that's one of these other types of organic compounds. I don't know if that answer
no.
your question.
It's okay. No, and I can probably word it better and send it to staff because I know we're not making a vote tonight. It was just kind of thinking about our distribution system and where our water treatment plant is and where water is needed. And making, I just didn't know if we had to do something along the way as we're getting water from one portion to a next, if it's doing the granulated active carbon at the water treatment plant.
If you were to,
and I'm in the third ward drinking
water.
Yeah,
if you were to put activated carbon in, you would put it at the water treatment plant and take care of it there, because that water is traveling through the distribution system, so you want to take out the organic carbon at the source, basically,
right.
and then keep it from reacting with other compounds as it, forming the disinfection byproducts as it moves forward.
Okay. Other council questions? Matt, you always have questions?
I do always have questions. I have several. I might be jumping around a little bit, and I might want to circle back after hearing from some other folks, but so on the bid packages, is there funding or plan or timeline on the deferred and the alternative portions of the project?
We will have to work through quite a bit of that. So you have, as Ryan mentioned, you have the base bid. The alternate, so the base bid right now we were estimating at $25 million. The add alternates, which are going to get bid with the base bid, are estimated currently at 4.1, and then the deferred improvements were $18 million. Ideally, we get some favorable bids and we're able to do the base bid and some of the add alternates, but we're being extremely conservative right now given the market conditions. We we will have to work through how we would fund a future project with the deferred, yes. This is very new as we've worked through revising our plans as we get ready to bid here. So we will work through that. You know, anything that's beyond our current budget, obviously we'll have to come back with a plan to you guys and present it as to how we would propose to fund it, rather than shifting some other projects or freeing up various other fundings if we want to add to the current project.
How many of those elements were included in the original, you know, project scope that we were talking about when we talked about this for the 2018 bond?
You have to remember that that's more of a high level estimate at that time in 2018 bond. As we got into design and got into more detail, some of the portions of design did evolve and consequently become more expensive. But in general, all those concepts were included when we approached the 2018 bond. I wasn't engaged at that time on setting the budget for the project, so I can't comment too much. Perhaps some others can, but we did go into the project in 2018 with those things identified, or with goals of doing so.
So the original goal was to do the base plus the add-on alternatives plus the deferred.
Ideally, yes.
And there was a $24.5 million budget originally.
That's correct.
And so now we're at 25 for the base plus 4 plus 18, so potentially 47 versus 24.5.
Correct.
And so of that, I mean, we're talking about almost doubling the project budget. And as you said, we're 4 years later. Is there any way to sort of break down how much of that would be, how much of that cost increase comes from, you know, the inflation that we talked about versus things that you discovered once you got further into design?
I think we could, to a certain extent, yes. Break some of that down.
Off the top of your head, do you know where you would weigh that more?
No, I mean, I would hesitate to do so. I would say that, you know, if without taking a more detailed look at it, you know, I would say at least half of that increase is probably associated with the market variability we've seen, if not more. But there were some items of the design that did evolve and become more expensive as we got into it and recognized things we needed to do. So,
what were some of those?
Would that be like slide 10? I'm counting the slides now.
How am I supposed to find that?
It's the market conditions price.
Oh, yeah, no. What were some of the things that, as you got into design, were, you know, needed more significant work than you had expected?
You know, I think in general it's across the board. Certainly the effluent pump station, which is which is the major component of what we're calling the deferred improvements now, certainly evolved and became quite a bit more costly than what we originally estimated or anticipated from previous studies and such we had done. There's certainly some additional things that were identified working with Kevin Wiggins, our water treatment plant manager, that we would like to do, you know, to make operations smoother, particularly related to chemical feed systems and such. I don't think we originally envisioned a totally new separate chemical feed building, but when we really dove into the design and looked at efficiencies of the plant and the improvements we could get out of that and safety for our workers, we quickly identified that we would be much better off to build that new building and move all of our chemical feed systems to a new building. So that's certainly a pretty significant add to the project as well.
The Electrical improvements, because I remember talking about that back in 2018, as that was kind of identified as a high priority need. So now you've shifted that into the deferred deferred portion of the project, which is the third and final one, right? The $18 million part. Could you describe just what some of those electrical needs are, what would be the benefit of them, what's the risk in not making them now?
The major thing that we will not be upgrading with the base bid and with those deferred improvements is the are the transformers at the plant and the main switch gear. All the components that we'll be replacing, motors and such, will be 480 volt motors, as most of them are now, with the exception of our high service pumps. So we won't be stranding assets eventually in a future project when we do switch to a different voltage at the plant. All those assets will still be there, but we will not be replacing the main switch gear and the transformers with the initial project. We wanted to do that just for ease of maintenance and the age of some of that equipment. We will be replacing a good portion of equipment as we step down on the control side, and some of the MCC gear and such that is older and been giving us some problems. But the main backbone of the system, as was referenced earlier by Ryan, we would not be proposing to replace initially, simply because of cost. So we're getting essentially reliable equipment. It's just we still have the older transformers in place still until a future project.
How old is that equipment?
It was original to the plant, so 1970 time period.
What's the expected useful life on it?
I'm not sure on the transformer per se, but we do have spares and backups for the transformers themselves. So
there are spare transformers available, and I would have to double check to see if any of those have actually, I think they've been replaced since 1970, but I'd have to double check that.
And what's this? Could you explain this moving from the 2400 volt to the 480 volt? Like, what's the rationale there? What's the benefit of doing that?
Well, it's just to get to a common voltage that's widely used in the industry today. Columbia historically had quite a bit of 2400 volt. It is not a common voltage. You know, a common medium voltage would be 4160 nowadays. 480 for low voltage. So it's just what's commonly used today. I mean, the only places where 2400 volt still exists in the city of Columbia is our water treatment plant, the West Ash Pump Station, and our power plant, I believe, still has a 2400 volt transformer, and that's it. It's just not a common voltage that's utilized anymore.
And when you do the West Ash project, you'll replace those?
Yes, that one is getting replaced there.
So how many transformers are at the treatment plant?
Two.
What happens if one of them goes down?
We're fine. They're redundant, essentially.
Okay.
And we have a spare, too. Have three, but.
You had a question, Nick?
Well, or just kind of related.
Come back to your microphone.
Oh, sorry. I just would like can you be more specific about how long we can defer those improvements that we're talking about?
Yes. I mean, each one has its own, individual criteria or needs. We did take a very hard look at it and, have prioritized them with what we're proposing. I do not have much issue personally with the deferred electrical improvements. We would like to see those happen. Ideally, I would say within the next 10 years, I wouldn't want to defer them any further than that. Well, actually, everything we propose to defer, ideally, we would do that in the next 10 years. I mean, that's a large enough sum. It would likely have to be part of a future bond issue, but.
One more at this point. That's okay. And the phased approach is an effort to address market conditions. Can you be more specific about how that will address the market conditions, doing it in a phased approach?
Well, I mean, it's just simply how we've broke it out. We tried to break down the base bid to get as close as we can to our, you know, with the base bid we would consider the absolute essential to the project is kind of how we reached that, you know.
So the phased approach really is just these different things with some things deferred, is that right?
Yes, yes, that's all.
We're basically saying, well, by a phased approach, we're basically saying there's some things we're just not going
to
do.
Yes, we have the base bid, which we need to find a way to get accomplished with this project. We have the add alternates. Whatever add alternates we're not going to be able to do with this initial phase of the project will become part of the deferred project.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically two phases. Just the first phase will be depending on how favorable of bids we get at the time we bid the project.
Betsy, do you have any? I have another one, and then, but also, Andrea or Pat, just wave your hand if you, and then I can notice. Sean, so going back, so originally 2018 estimate 24, right? 24 million, some right, for this project. We're now, the base is the 25. Are we able to cover that different? Like, what is, where are we finding that funding gap for those, as well as the potential go in? And then I know we ask at most council meetings, are we going for any of the federal or state ARPA fund or stimulus investment funds, infrastructure funds, to help with this needed project?
Obviously, we're certainly staying abreast of what funds become available. We did pursue some funding for the West Ash Pump Station, which we were hoping to free up some a little bit of funding there to assist with the plant. We did not get that grant. So we will look for future opportunities as they come around. I would propose, you know, that we take bids on the project and see where we're at. Obviously, we'd have to come back to you for any additional appropriation. I think there are some projects identified in our future CIP that we can juggle around some and free up some level of funding, depending on how much it is. But I mean, we'll have to address that when we come to it, certainly. And ideally, we will see some more favorable bidding than our conservative estimates that we've okay. put together right now. But we want to remain extremely conservative because I mean it's a very dynamic market right now, and I don't envy these guys that have to put together cost estimates at all because it's a new world. So.
And what is the timeline for this coming? Because I know originally we thought this might be coming to us at our meeting next Monday, but I don't think it is at that time. So what is the timeline? And then I know we're balancing both the sale of the next round of bonds.
We're completing a final review of the documents, our design documents, now that we've made some modifications. We're anticipating with HDR to submit for our permit with MDNR mid-December here. I think December 16th is actually our target date that we've earmarked to get everything sent off for permitting. And then that process can take a fair amount of time. We're optimistic that it'll go fairly fast, but that could be 3 to 6 months on that process. I could let others speak in regards to the bond sales and when that's gonna occur if they so desire.
But I'm just wondering, yeah. What's next steps and when does this come back to us? The reason why we want to have this is so that we could ask some of these questions that we've had just before it comes back to us for any votes.
Director Liu can probably provide some insight on the sale of bonds, and then we can follow up from there.
Okay.
Good evening. So the sale of the bonds, we've been back and forth with S&P for a few months now, and a lot of it is going to hinge on what we are going to do with the electric rates. And so right now we've kind of postponed the
electric or water rates?
Electric.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, because they're tied together in the charter. So it's water and light, and so when they rate them, they rate them together as a group instead of separately. And so we're looking at possibly a March timeline to sell the bonds. And that seems like when everything would be in line with being ready to start the project, and hopefully we would have something settled with the electric.
What kind of feedback did you get regarding the electric rates?
From S&P?
Yeah.
Potential downgrade of the rating. Not a letter downgrade, but a negative outlook.
With rates where they are?
Yes.
And did they indicate what they need, what they would like to see to maintain the ratings?
They did not say what, I mean, they won't tell us exactly what they would like to see. We proposed, we had put together some numbers based on assumptions, and that, I believe that was sent to you all today. That sufficed for them. They were pretty good with those, but after speaking with bond counsel and a few other people, they would rather see solid numbers rather than speculation.
So the other part of the cost increase here related to the delay in this project is that we're talking about a different level of interest rates.
That's correct.
2 years ago or 3 years ago.
Pat or Andrea, do either of you have any questions? Andrea, you're good. All right, Pat, do you want to unmute yourself? And it might be for, I'm not sure it would be for you, Matt. Stay close.
Mute myself. There we go. I do. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm looking at the email that came today from the Safe Water Coalition and also the attached letter dated March 9th, 2018, where the work group, the Drinking Water Planning Work Group, made two findings. And I wonder if you would pull that up and tell me how what we've listened to today matches those two findings. Do you have that letter? It was attached to the email.
It was sent to staff.
I have not received that email that I know of.
So you can pull this up off the website, I assume. I'm happy to share my screen so you can look at it if that's possible on your webinar. But the letter is dated March 9, 2018. It's from the Drinking Water Planning Work Group. It's entitled Final Recommendations of the Drinking Water Planning Work Group. The findings were as follows. The McBain Water Treatment Plant should consider processes that meet the requirements for a groundwater under direct influence, and they give an acronym for that, facility. Now, I've heard you make reference to it, but I didn't hear that you were striving to comply with that different level of scrutiny. And then the next point is the McBain Water Treatment Plant should utilize treatment technologies to achieve disinfection byproduct compliance without the use of chloramines, and to also assist in the removal of contaminants of emerging concerns. So I don't profess to understand much of what we've talked about today, except that I do understand that there are byproducts of disinfection that we are leaving in the water, and we are not striving at a time where we're doing this design to incorporate a known solution for that, because we profess that that would be too expensive. So I'm interested into why, once again, we are not taking that into consideration. And how is it that we locked ourselves down with a budget that doesn't include those two steps?
We can certainly address those. There's two bullet points that you referenced, and this was the findings of the Drinking Water Planning Work Group. I pulled those up here in front of me. So the first of which was the McBain Water Treatment Plant should consider processes that meet requirements for groundwater under the direct influence. I'll touch on that, and perhaps Ryan can come up and further elaborate. All the components that we did design into the current improvement project, we did take that into account. Until we're able to complete what we're now calling the deferred improvements, I can't stand before you and say that we'll 100% meet groundwater under direct influence requirements. certainly if we were to implore all the improvements that we originally set out to do, that was a goal of the project. And Ryan, do you want to elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, so there's several components to groundwater under the influence compliance. We have, as Sean mentioned, strived to achieve those. One of them is with regard to disinfection. We've done the calculations to confirm that we meet the disinfection requirements for groundwater under the influence compliance. Another one is filter effluent turbidity. Our goal is that with all of the treatment unit process performance improvements we're doing as part of the project, that the filters are able to produce a finished water turbidity that is groundwater under the influence compliant. But the high service pumps do complicate that. So until we, I think, construct the improvements and optimize the plant and see how we're doing, we won't know for sure whether or not we're meeting that all of the time, but it is a goal of the project. The pump station makes that a lot more achievable, but not necessarily, pump station isn't necessarily required for largely compliance of groundwater and the influence. So we have strived to achieve as much as we can within the base bid improvements. Sean said, I'm not 100% certain that we're going to be fully compliant all the time, but it has been a big part of our evaluation and our studies.
Does it not make more sense to strive to get this right the first time than to build something that kind of sort of gets us there but doesn't? Because really, I mean, there's a lot of technical information I don't understand about what we've just talked about, but I do understand when someone, and you have explained to me, that the time that the water spends in the distribution system means that we are intentionally, inadvertently, acknowledging, knowingly passing through byproducts of disinfection, which are on a watch list as being potential carcinogens. And so if we're going to undertake to do this, why don't we undertake to do all of it in a way that protects our medically fragile residents, that also puts us in a position that we're not having to revisit these kinds of improvements with the water treatment plant for the next X number of years? Because we know what, once you get underway with this, we're not coming back around to it anytime soon. So I don't understand the reluctance of taking that into consideration, particularly since you've identified a strategy that would remove those byproducts, given that it does not appear that you want to move away from using an ammonia-based disinfection treatment system.
Yes, I think some of your comments relate to the second bullet point you brought up too on imploring treatment technologies for disinfection byproduct compliance. I want to emphasize that we do currently meet regulations. We are not currently classified as a groundwater under direct influence. We are classified as a groundwater plant. We do anticipate it will stay that way for quite some time. I don't want to mislead anybody. We do certainly currently meet all regulations. The items we are talking about are potential future regulations. I think we've done a good job with this project in preparing. That was the whole reasoning for including Task 3 in HDR scope of services was for the alternative analysis, which Trent presented earlier. I think we as staff have always visioned that as a future project, as not part of this current project. If you'll go on in some of the drinking water work group's recommendations, the first and primary focus was to restore the plant's capacity, which if you'll recall the goals we presented to the project, that's the very first one, is to restore the capacity and consequently gain reliability. So I think we need to separate these a little bit. We are looking at that as a future project at this point in time. Yes, that will take some time. That also takes a substantial amount of money, which is ultimately the ratepayers have to pick up. So the point I was, and I'm sure Ryan will elaborate a little bit more, but we're at a point where advanced treatment and some of these technologies we're talking about, it without regulations in place, and I can't tell you how soon it'll be that additional regulations will come into play. They're typically very slow to come into play. We're not anticipating them in the near future. Anything that we would struggle to meet anyway with our current process. So it becomes a community decision because it becomes a substantial cost, which ultimately the ratepayers have to pick up. So I think it's going to involve a lot of future discussion on what we do.
And Sean, let me clarify something. I think it was something that you said, that when we're talking about this, especially in the phased approach and where we are right now making the investments in just making sure you're up to what your capacity is supposed to do, we are not stranding any assets if we do decide to change later on. So this is not an either or. This is not, we either make these investments in our plant right now to get it up to the capacity that it needs, or we invest in the alternative transport or the alternative treatment. We can do, right now we just need to get it up to capacity.
That's correct. I mean, we have to do the improvements with this current project before we do anything additional. If the heart of the plant doesn't work.
Right. And it would continue to work.
Yes.
Regardless of what our treatment is, yes, as we continue. Okay.
Did you have anything?
Let me understand the $1.67 a month. What is the improvement that would result in an increase in our monthly rate paying bill of $1.67? Is that
that was just simply a reference for every, we have roughly 50,000 customers. So every $1 million we add to our operational cost every year would, you know, just simple math would mean that if we evenly divided it, that each customer would pay, you know, $1.67 a month. That's all that was. Right now our estimates are in the, you know, $4 to $6 million a year additional operational cost to add GAC to the plant. As Trent indicated, that number will likely come down some. It's still going to be a very substantial number. We are likely to see some gains in performance, and particularly TOC removal with the improvements that we're proposing to the basin equipment at the plant, which will then reduce the loading on the GAC filters and consequently reduce that operational cost, because a large portion of the operational cost is the GAC media itself. But that was just meant to be a generalized statement that every $1 million of operational cost, and how that potentially impacts a customer. Obviously, that's also impacted by whatever rate structure and such is implored at the time. It's likely not going to be 100% evenly divided. But just for reference, it is significant. We're talking, you know, likely more than a 50% increase to our operational cost at our water plant. If we implored such technology. So just wanted you guys to be aware of it.
50%. So you said for each $1 million of an increase in operating costs, that would be $1.67. So when you're talking about there's the construction costs and then there's the operating costs. So if we go to implementing that GAC system in order to remove the byproducts of disinfection, and how many times do we need to multiply $1.67?
It would totally depend on how the capital costs were financed and consequently then distributed. But if you just look at it from an operational cost, I mean, it's right now we're estimating at $4 to $6 million a year. So, fairly sizable potential increase if we were to go ahead and implore those technologies.
So I have a calculator, and at that it would be an additional $10.02 per ratepayer per month in order to remove those byproducts of disinfection.
I don't want to get, because I'm assuming that we don't actually know the cost right now, and you're kind of, I'm just asking.
Very high level cost estimates at this point in time, and that we threw that point out just for reference. I mean, and that's something we have to obviously consider. These are unregulated items at this point, and so it's very definitely a consideration that I would expect us all to have, because it does impact our customers so significantly. So
right.
So what's the grace period when it's unregulated now, and then say it becomes regulated? We all are familiar with this idea of what we call grandfathering something in. So how long do the appropriate regulatory authorities give you to become compliant with new regulations, and do we have the ability to act that either that slowly or that quickly should they start regulating these particular byproducts?
I would not anticipate anything in the near future of, you know, regulation that would impact us in our current operation that we would not be able to meet. To your question specifically, you typically have years to comply. I won't say exactly what that would be. Maybe Trent or Ryan could add to that a little bit.
Do you have a crystal ball?
Compliance with new regulations.
Wait, come up to the microphone, please.
The implementation of that regulation, if NDMA, for example, was brought in as a regulated compound, would have a compliance schedule essentially baked into the rule, similar to rules that are coming out, that came out with the lead and copper rule revision and so forth. So there'll be an implementation mechanism. You've got to recognize that like 50% of the country's population drinks chloraminated water. So it's, you know, bringing that forward is going to require some evaluation of the implementation.
Just to clarify for those who are in the audience and new, that is what we have. 50% of the country, you're saying, have the same sort of water treatment we do. So
I think it's like 50% of the population served.
Okay. Has the same as us, and so they would all be going for the same change to the rules.
Yeah, same mechanism. Those federal regulations roll through the state regulatory process in a pretty streamlined fashion for the Safe Drinking Water Act.
And can I clarify on this? Are we expecting that this is going to come, or is this just like in case this happens, prepare for this sort of regulation rule?
There's no there's no immediate indication that maximum contaminant levels are going to be set for NDMA.
Okay.
EPA evaluated that previous years, and there was complications in trying to figure out what the right level of MCL would be.
Okay. And back to your comment, Sean, we're at 40% of what?
50% of the regulated level of trihalomethanes. For some of those others, haloacetic acids and so forth, were well below. We're like 20%.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I wasn't done asking.
Oh, sorry, Pat. Sorry. Go on, Pat.
So I understand you're saying that 50% of the population drinks water with the same component pieces, but we did convene a working group and we asked them to work on recommendations and findings that were important to our community. And they have made a recommendation that we work to eliminate the use of ammonia-based disinfectant and go back to, I think it's, is it free chlorine, which is the alternative, and that we remove the contaminants that the water picks up during the disinfection process. So I'm still struggling with why we're not following that recommendation that was given back in 2018. And I wasn't on council then, so I didn't have the same perspective that Mr. Pitzer and Dr. Peters have about being on council at the time. But I still don't get why we're, I'm at a loss for why we're not following their recommendations.
As I was stating earlier, I believe, you know, in our opinion that we are following those. We did study the advanced treatment with the design of this project. You know, one of their other bullets was to restore the capacity first. And when you pull all things together, particularly the monetary component of it, perhaps we're on some different timelines, but I professionally, I think we have some time to make these decisions. I think we should be very careful and cautious as we do proceed with them. We've taken steps to be prepared for a future project. We will continue to do so moving forward. With no regulation in place, we as staff, we simply can't recommend going forward with these other improvements or advanced treatment at this time, given the cost of them. So, I mean, I think that's kind of where we're at. I think it's, if we are going to do something of that nature without regulations being a driver, I really feel that needs to be a community decision, and we need to do some work to put it out in front of our customers and let them weigh in on it.
So how would that work, Sean? How would we put that out in front of our customers?
We're getting pretty far down the road there. I don't know that we've
That might be a city manager kind of question. Then thank you, Sean.
So again, please let me continue.
I was just directing your question to the person who could answer it, which would be the city manager rather than the project on this. Do you want to ask your question to Carlin?
Sure. How would we put that out in front of the public, Mr. Seawood?
And the first step is we have to actually decide on our process and how we're moving forward. So if the idea is that we're first going to look at bringing the facility up to the standard that it should be, and this first initial project, which is we've been talking about. And then the second point is if we were only to look at the advanced project, then we would do like we normally do. We would do a public process where we'll actually engage our citizens. We'll talk about what the different alternatives are and figure out how do we move forward from there. But the first part is to look at where we're at right now and how do we move it to this project that we've been talking about for a while. And coming in as city manager in February, there's quite a few projects that we've been talking about and where we're at. And so this is a process to start moving some of those projects forward.
Well, I would also, I assume everybody has, let me see how many people, I believe it did go to Mr. Seawood as well. There is a list of questions and comments that the Safe Water Coalition have submitted. And I'd like to ask that staff respond to that and bring a report back to council for those points. The Safe Water Coalition and their members were part of the drinking water planning group and have continued to engage in it. And I think they've asked some very thoughtful questions. So may we have a report that responds to those questions?
Sure, we can bring that back at a future council meeting.
Thank you.
Before we're asked to vote on anything for the water treatment plant, please.
Oh, yeah, we can have that before we're asked to vote on the water treatment plant process.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Pat?
No, thank you.
Okay, I'm done. Andrea, are you good? Okay. Any other questions? Matt, you do?
Betsy? I do, yeah.
Okay. Do you have any? All right, Matt, back to you.
Okay. I wrote a few other ones down here, sorry. So Trent, you mentioned that you had some recommendations for reducing the time that water spends in the distribution system. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, we, as part of the alternatives evaluation that's linked up with the pilot study, we evaluated the hydraulic model of the system and made recommendations on different operational controls to reduce the water age in certain parts of the city. The city's now moving forward on a drinking water master plan, and so for the distribution system, so probably the adequate time to pick the, you know, reevaluate those recommendations.
Okay. Are those capital investments?
Most of them, it's been quite a while, sorry okay. about that. But most of them were operational. Like how you operate the water storage tanks, maybe change some of the valving and so forth, but pretty much low-cost solutions.
Okay, so there is the potential for some improvements on some of those metrics by making those changes.
Yeah, and just overall, it's, you know, you always want to try to strive for the lowest water age you can have in these systems. So regardless of the issue at hand there, I would recommend.
Okay. And then was GAC the, or is GAC the only alternative treatment process that you looked at in depth to return to free chlorine?
We evaluated these granular activated carbon GAC contactors as a separate unit, which is capital intensive. We also evaluated using GAC in the existing filters, which would be no capital essentially. And then we evaluated this, if you remember, the biologically active filtration, which uses GAC, but you don't replace the GAC. You use organisms to actually break it down and then disinfect after that. And that was the one we had. We were optimistic that that might be a viable solution. That would be a low-cost, sustainable way to manage the issue to get to free chlorine. We just didn't see in the studies that we had that that was viable. Now, if there's improvements with the amount of organic carbon removal, that might be something to put back on the table.
Okay.
Makes sense?
Not really. I guess I don't understand why you don't think it's viable.
Because we couldn't hit a reasonable disinfection byproduct target with the pilot study that we had. So when we ran that type of process, we couldn't meet regulatory compliance with the total trihalomethanes.
But you have some reason to think that in the future you could?
Well, if we reduce the amount of organic carbon that's coming into the system, then we don't have as much delta to change in
carbon. So if we make these other improvements, then maybe that's...
Then maybe it becomes more viable.
Okay.
So again, I don't want to, our whole evaluation was to select the processes, provide the cost, and those sorts of things to make an informed decision moving forward. So I don't want to convey that I'm opposed to implementing granular activated carbon. That's a community decision. It comes with a significant cost, and if our community, I'm speaking more as a customer, but if our community supports that, then hey, that's what we should do.
On the biofiltration alternative, one of the reasons we think it didn't perform as well as we expected it to perform is because we were picking up pretreated water out of the secondary basins right now. And with some of the inefficiencies in the pretreatment process, we were thinking that it might have negatively impacted the performance of the biofiltration. But when we do the base bid improvements and we improve the chemical feed systems, the aeration system, the clarifiers, the lime feed process and all that, we expect to send a lot less turbidity or solids to the filters. And under that condition, it's possible that biofiltration would perform much better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, that's...
But the good news is that with all the data that we collected, we can still use those data after we see what the performance is and likely not require another pilot study like we had. We can go back and look at those data and draw some correlations and figure out where we would land in terms of costs and viability.
And speaking of that, you know, when we make the base bid improvements, what sort of metrics would you use to measure performance improvement?
From those systems, we would track the amount of organic carbon through the system, so what gets removed at various stages in the system. Also, important part of it, like Ryan mentioned, was turbidity, especially when we evaluate the compliance or the target of meeting groundwater under the influence compliance, even though that's not our endpoint right now. But we could evaluate the turbidity going into the filters, out of the filters, and so forth to really dial in what the performance is.
And this is all data that we're collecting currently and that we'll continue to collect? Or?
Yeah, some of that it would be probably outside of the norm of most utilities, but it's not substantially expensive. It would be something I think Kevin would probably want to collect on his own, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Another question, are there long-term negatives to continuing to use chloramines, either on the operations of the plant, on the some sort of effect on the distribution system?
Yeah, it does make it more complicated at the water treatment plant. You're adding another chemical. You've got to make sure that they're in balance so that you have the right amount of, you don't overfeed the amount of ammonia into the system. So I think from an operability standpoint, the preference would be probably to go to free chlorine. But in the system, you just have to monitor to make sure that there's that the amount of chloramines you have in the system persist long enough, and that you don't have biological activity, which could be a problem in some chloraminated systems. It hasn't been a problem in Columbia.
But there's no long-term degradation to the pipes or anything like that?
Not that's...
Okay.
One thing I would say, and I know Dr. Peters, you might track some of this, but there is concerns right now about Legionella, particularly in systems, in like hotels and so forth, in the hot water systems. And that is usually due to a lack of residual of the disinfectant into a hot water system. So that's actually what CDC recommends for that issue, is actually chloramination. But, again, we can manage it with free chlorine as well. It's just one of those things that requires diligence on both secondary disinfectants.
And this is, I don't know if it's for you or whomever, but once work actually starts on the base bid project, what's the construction timeline there?
I think in our current documents we have 2 years. It might be plus or minus 3 months. We kind of went back and forth as we put together the contract documents, and we're finalizing that right now. Maybe 3 months longer than originally intended due to some of the long lead items and things like that.
So it sounds like we're not talking about being able to actually start this work before like next summer, right? Summer of 23. So 2 years, summer of 25 is kind of an optimistic.
Probably so. Mm-hmm. Usually for complicated water treatment projects, it's about 2 years. I would say 18 months is the minimum, but there's enough going on in this plant and enough phasing and sequencing that has to happen that probably 2 years to 2 years plus is what we'd be looking at.
Any other questions?
None.
Betsy, did you have a question?
I don't have any other questions. I have a comment. Thank you for arranging this tonight. I sort of feel like Pat, even though I've listened to this a lot longer than she has, perhaps. But I feel like I need to go home now that we have the presentation, so thank you. And just go over it again so that my questions are more knowledgeable than they would be otherwise. So I appreciate not rushing through this at a pre-council meeting.
Yeah, and this is obviously not the last time we're going to be talking about this or asking questions of you. Appreciate you all having this and to you all for coming. Because we don't want to tie up our regular meeting. We want to hopefully come into the meeting with informed conversation and giving you the opportunity to get the answers to those questions. So I look forward to seeing the report on an upcoming council meeting from the email we got. And as always, I encourage all council members and anyone to send your questions in. It always helps us be all informed on the decisions we're going forward. Sean, do you have anything else you need to do before I adjourn us?
I would just add real quickly, I did have one final slide I'd like to remind the council, and particularly the newer members. All the project information, it's recently been consolidated, actually. So if you just go to the Be Heard site and click on the water treatment plant project, you'll get a lot of the background. There's a fairly lengthy report on the alternative analysis, per se, that goes into much more detail than we did tonight on what we did look at. There's several informational videos and some other stuff that we've put out at past meetings and such. So if you have any questions, I would encourage you to go take a look, and perhaps that generates more questions for us. But we're happy to answer them. But there is a lot of information out there, and the simple way to get to it is to hit the Be Heard site and click on the project, and there'll be several links on the right-hand side. and a lot of commonly asked questions. So.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Sean. Thank you, staff. Any other? We're good? Matt, you have a comment.
Well, I don't know. Are we having discussion? Or?
I figured we still have a lot of questions to go, so I was going to adjourn us since we'll continue this discussion. But did you have a quick comment similar?
I think we should think about, you know, what we were talking about with this phased approach, and also think about plans to be able to accomplish some of those things, because, you know, there are some critical elements that we were originally talking about doing in 2018 that are not being contemplated now with this base bid. You know, the electrical backbone system, which is a fairly important item, and this high surface pump station. You know, and those are critical to the performance of the plant, and, you know, it looks like they're going to be pushed off and probably not addressed. So, you know, I would like to have a little bit more thought and discussion around how do we actually accomplish what we need to really accomplish to make total improvements.
Right. So when putting together the next steps on this, I think having what are some options we have for that besides just we might need to go for another bond, like what are...
No, we'll have something that talks about potential funding for some of the alternatives, what that looks like in a time frame or a timeline for when we can actually start going out to look at those projects.
I don't even think they're called alternatives. I think they're called like the deferred needs.
I understand.
So, yeah. Yeah, no, I agree, Matt. All right. Any other comments? All right. I'm going to go ahead and adjourn our pre-council at 6:31. Thank you all.